Hello, I'm Marion Marshall with the BBC News. Members of the European Parliament are holding a secret ballot to decide whether the outgoing German Defence Minister, Ursula von der Leyen, would become the first woman to run the European Commission. She's pitched policies designed to offer something to all sides. Damian Grammaticus reports from Strasbourg.
To try to win left-wing votes, she's promised the EU, under her direction, will legislate for a minimum wage and for gender quotas on company boards. To attract Greens, she said the EU should do more to reduce carbon emissions. To attract Liberal votes, she's promising protections for the rights of refugees and tougher monitoring to ensure countries like Hungary and Poland comply with EU democratic values. But those policies may cost her votes among Eurosceptic and hard right-wing parties. If Ms. von der Leyen is rejected, the EU will face a new period of deep political uncertainty.
President Trump says that progress has been made in efforts to de-escalate tensions between the US and Iran. He didn't go into any details, but his Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, said the Iranians were prepared to negotiate on the issue of their ballistic missile development program. The US wants to rein this in. Tehran hasn't yet responded. US federal prosecutors say they will not press charges against any New York police officer involved in the death of a black man, which led to the Black Lives Matter movement 5 years ago. Eric Garner died after he was put in a chokehold during his arrest for allegedly selling untaxed cigarettes in Staten Island. Richard Donahue is the US attorney for the District of Eastern New York.
After an exhaustive investigation, the Department of Justice has reached the conclusion that insufficient evidence exists to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the police officers who arrested Eric Garner in Staten Island on July 17th of 2014 acted in violation of the Federal Criminal Civil Rights Act.
Footage of the incident, which showed Eric Garner gasping, "I can't breathe," played a key role in protests against excessive use of force by police confronting black men. 50 years after the first manned mission to the moon was launched, events have begun in the United States to commemorate the Apollo 11 program. One of the three astronauts, Michael Collins, who never set foot on the moon, was in Florida to describe his experiences. Our correspondent there, Jane O'Brien, listened to his account.
When he said he was leery of how the stage two part of the rocket detachment would work, you can imagine him sitting in that tiny little thing, thinking, well, is it going to work? Is it not going to work? I found that absolutely incredible. And to hear him actually describe that moment, that was quite incredible and really gives you a sense of just how extraordinary this anniversary is.
Jane O'Brien reporting. World News from the BBC. The Congolese authorities say that a pastor, who was the first confirmed victim of Ebola in the crowded eastern city of Goma, has died. The provincial governor called for calm, saying that the case had been detected quickly and isolated immediately, and that passengers on the pastor's bus have also been identified. A broadcasting regulator in Belgium has opened an investigation into a TV news report about tourists who said their holidays had been spoiled by the bodies of dead migrants washing up on the beach. The comments were made by Belgian citizens on holiday on the Tunisian island of Djerba. Here's our Europe regional editor, Mike Sanders.
The report on a francophone television channel cuts straight to the chase. A bad start to the holiday for Charlotte from Liège, said the reporter. She just arrived in Tunisia and she found a body on the beach. Similar tales of ruined vacations ensued. The tone triggered condemnation on social media and complaints to the regulator. One newspaper decried the revolting asymmetry between those from the north who can travel at leisure and those from the south who risk their lives to do so. It said the report had dehumanised migrants, replacing humanity with unbridled selfishness.
10 Turkish sailors have been taken hostage by armed pirates off the coast of Nigeria. Their ship, which was not carrying freight, was sailing from Cameroon to Ivory Coast when the pirates boarded. 8 other sailors managed to escape. Piracy in Nigeria has become common over the past decade, but there's been a recent drop in the number of incidents. The International Maritime Bureau warns that Nigerian waters remain risky. The final season of the popular television series Game of Thrones has received a record-breaking 32 nominations at the annual American TV Awards, the Emmys. The medieval fantasy series has set the record for most nominations given to any show in a single year. The Emmy Award ceremony will take place in September in Los Angeles. BBC News.
The Madison Rafah Sister City Project presents Dessert in a Presentation featuring Kathy Kelly of Voices for Creative Nonviolence on Thursday, July 25th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the James Reeb Unitarian Congregation. This summer, the Gaza Freedom Flotilla organizers are touring the U.S. to build awareness about Gaza and raise funds. Kathy Kelly and Kit Kittredge of the Flotilla will talk about the history and future plans of the organization. Refreshments and desserts will be served. Palestinian crafts and olive oil will be offered for sale. This event is free, but donations will be gladly accepted. More information about Madison's sister city is at madisonrafah.org. The MRSCP presents Kathy Kelly of Voices for Creative Nonviolence at the James Reeb Unitarian Congregation on Thursday, July 25th from 7 to 9 p.m. You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison and WORTFM.org.
6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before.
Hello and welcome to A Public Affair. It's Tuesday, so that means you've got me. I'm Carousel Baird. And we have fabulous, an exciting show lined up today. Such a fabulous guest sitting right across from me right here in the studio is Madison Metropolitan School District current superintendent. She's still here in charge of all the fabulous thing. It is Dr. Jennifer Cheatham. Hello,
hey,
Jen.
Hey, Carousel. Hey, everybody. It's good to be here.
Wonderful to have you. And I do want to just kick it off. You know, you're leaving at the end of the summer, moving on to other adventures, but to say, first of all, thank you to your accessibility. We've had a lot of conversations with you and many of your leaders. They aren't always easygoing conversations.
They're,
but they're important conversations. And your availability to answer questions and be on the show and come and have these conversations is really important to Madison. So thank you.
Well, thank you for asking. It's been wonderful every time, and I'm sure it'll be wonderful again
Another
today.
Great show.
That's
of
right. We're going to make it happen.
I don't know. I'll burn down all the bridges. You're leaving town. I got nothing to lose. All right. Well, let's sort of start with I have very few statistics that I brought with me today, but just a few.
Okay.
Just a few. There's approximately 27,000 students.
Correct.
In MMSD. More than 50% are students of color, including 18% that have self-identified as African-American, 21% that have identified as Latinx, 32 elementary schools, 12 middle schools, 6 high schools.
There you go. Those are the stats.
It's big for Dane County, but it's not huge in compared to other big cities. Does that make it more manageable? Do those numbers seem like, okay, I can work with those. When 6 years ago, when you showed up and you said, I want to be the superintendent of Madison, it felt like a world that you could play a role in.
No doubt. No doubt. I think you know this, Carousel, but I worked in San Diego before coming to Madison, where there are 200 schools. Then Chicago, where at that time there were about 600 schools. And so coming to Madison, it did seem doable to me. The challenges seemed hard, even from the outside. But they seemed doable. I always imagined, wow, I could have all 50 principals in a room together.
Right.
And we can just talk, real talk. And that's been true. I mean, it's been wonderful in that way. Yeah, big challenges, but doable because of the size and the community that we live in.
It's been good. First of all, congratulations on your new position. You're moving off to Harvard University. I think that bodes well for us, that leaders from Madison move on to Harvard University.
There you go.
So thanks for representing Madison at Harvard. That's excellent.
No doubt. I think sometimes when we're in our own communities, we lose perspective on them. And as much as we have challenges, we have tremendous strengths. And school districts outside of Madison nationally have looked to us, right? Have come to us for guidance and advice, for lessons learned, some of them learn the hard way, right? But important lessons that we've gleaned. So I want people to know that not only have we made progress here within our community, but we've been already, Madison's been influencing the field of education beyond Madison.
How is that? Right, when we're in it, all we see are the challenges.
Right.
Because like, okay, here's another problem. Let's work on that. Here's another. And, you know, that's the daily job of solving problems. But to understand that, is it because we're at least a community that is willing to address the challenges instead of trying to ignore them?
I think so. I think that's a part of it. I had a, and still have, a longtime mentor named Carl Cohn. He was the superintendent in Long Beach many years ago. And I remember my early days working with Carl, he called this work, he describes it as a hard slog, right? The hard slog of school improvement, right? It's not, you don't get to spike the football much, right? There's always another challenge to address,
right?
And it's ultimately about children, right? So it's like schools and school districts that are at the center of humanity, right? And all the challenges that come with being alive, right, exist in a school, in a classroom, in a school district. So, it's challenging work. But I, to your point, I think that Madison has, as a community, right, of educators, but of people, have been able, I think, to talk about hard issues together. I'd love to talk about that more, actually.
No. Oh, yeah.
I think it's a major asset that we don't talk about enough, our ability to be in dialogue with one another.
Even if we disagree, even if we don't go the route that, you know, change makers want to go, the fact that we're willing to have those conversations. I think that that's really valid. Let's talk about, so you've been here for 6+ years. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the changes that you've seen in that 6+ years.
I think there have been a lot of changes.
Okay.
And I mean, of course, everyone's going to think that they're for the better, but I would say that they're for the better. I think mostly they have been for the better. When I started 6+ years ago, the general sentiment, it was a difficult time in Madison, by the way. The context, Act 10 had just happened.
Mm-hmm.
So the education community was feeling incredibly demoralized.
Devastated.
Right?
Devastated.
I mean, you don't get over those feelings, actually. I think they're hard to get over.
Yes.
What else was happening at that time? The right as I was starting, the Race to Equity report was released. So everyone was kind of grappling with the realities of the disparities between Black and white people in our community.
Putting numbers to the communities of color knew these challenges all along, and no longer could the white communities of Madison deny them when the numbers were boldly in their face.
Right. So think about that, though. So here we have teachers, staff, educators feeling demoralized because of Act 10 and simultaneously being faced with the reality of these disparities, right? That's really challenging. What else was happening at that time? The Urban League proposal for the charter school, right, had just been denied.
Boy, that was a tough moment in Madison.
Right. It was a tough moment.
It was a very racialized conversation.
Tell me about it.
Oh, yeah.
It was intense. And so that was the context that I came into.
Welcome.
Yeah, right. And I'm inherently a very optimistic person. So I thought, yeah, we can do this. This is hard, but there's an inflection point here, right? We can come together and find a better way of doing this. And I felt like all the ingredients existed in Madison to do so. So it's interesting, like given all that context, what came up in those first few months when I was on the job was a desire for just direction and coherence, right? There was this feeling that the district at that point in time, which is a point of, I think, some chaos, right? There's, that was a chaotic period of not knowing what direction to go and knowing that we were facing challenges, but not knowing how to move forward. Everyone just needed and wanted desperately some direction, right? And some coherence around the strategies that were being put into play. So I took that and ran with it. And I think over these last 5 or 6 years, we've accomplished that. Meaning we have real direction. I still get regularly criticized for doing too much, right? That's different from not having direction.
And it's hard when there's so many things to do, to have, I'm sure, a desire to fix everything at once, and yet you have to move all the balls forward a little bit at a time.
I think that's true. So my challenge has always been, well, okay, we're going to have to do a lot, because there's urgency, right? And there are children who need us to make progress now. So I can't narrow the focus too much, but at least I can make sure that what we're doing is coherent, right? That it all holds together and is leading us in a direction that's addressing the real problems that we face, right? Not the fake problems, mm-hmm. but the real ones. And again, I think we've accomplished that. I really wanted for us to adopt some more disciplined ways of working. I wanted us out of the gate to invest in school leadership teams, school improvement planning, data use. I just wanted us to be a more disciplined organization.
To have a sense of structure.
Yeah, to have structure, to have systems and structures and shared leadership structures that would help the people who work most closely with children to be empowered to make the best possible decisions.
I remember
that.
I remember when you moved here. Yeah. I have a seventh grader, so mm-hmm. I had just gotten to know Madison Public Schools, right? Mm-hmm. I was an observer on some level before you became our superintendent. And I remember having a conversation with Marge Passman, who is a mentor and good friend of mine, who was a member of the Madison School Board at the time, talking about how my daughter's first grade class wasn't learning the same thing at another first grade class across town, still in Madison, because that wasn't the structure that we had.
Yeah.
And that on some level there was a lot of teacher freedom, but on another level, kids, you couldn't switch schools and expect to be able to have the same curriculum, and you would either be advanced or behind, mm-hmm. depending on where you go, just because you moved apartments across the city.
Well, that's an excellent point.
It's not like that anymore.
No. And so in addition to creating more discipline in the ways we make decisions and how we measure success and learn from our failures and make improvement over time, we insisted on more instructional coherence. So let's get clear on what we think great teaching looks like in the classroom. Let's get clear on the standards, right, that we have to teach, especially in literacy and mathematics. That has been the major focus for these past 5-6 years. And we insisted on teachers not working in isolation, but working in teams, right? So there was a big investment in not just as a learning community understand how we teach, but knowing a little bit more about what we all need to teach and how we need to work together as teams to continually reflect on the effectiveness of our practice. So teachers coming together on a regular basis to talk about what we taught last week, what do we learn from it, which kids are getting it, who isn't, what does that mean for what we're going to do next week, right? And that sounds simple, but it is just essential. I mean, that is the core of what school districts do.
And I could see, I feel like every time you start a new initiative or change things up, not you specifically, but everyone in general, you almost have to go all in. Okay, this is what we're doing. And then once you master it, you can pull back out. So I could see a lot of challenges and difficulties of teachers that were fabulous teachers.
Oh, yeah.
That weren't, of course they taught our kids. Of course, they were fabulous, qualified teachers, but they weren't as interested in making sure that their first grader was doing the same as another first grader was doing. They had love and nurturing, and they wanted to inspire these students to love education. Yeah. And not that they have to be, I can't think of the right word, combative with each other, mm-hmm. but there were definitely teachers that thrived because of the free form that we allowed. And here you
adding
a structure to it. Where do you think we are in the process? Do you think there's a point where we can say, okay, you've mastered the structure, now we can pull back out?
Yeah, oh my God, it's such a good question. I think that both the disciplined ways of working that I described first and this work that we've done around instructional coherence was, for a while and for some, felt really constraining, mm-hmm. right, to your point.
I bet it would.
For great principals who felt like they had a leadership structure that was working, or, you know, like there were principals who were feeling those constraints too, mm-hmm. And certainly teachers. And I've talked with enough teachers to know for a fact that that is absolutely true. But I think what I've always believed was that it was a step in the process, right? Which is, I think, is your point. Mm-hmm. But that's not the end goal. The end goal is something more important. The end goal for those disciplined ways of working at the school and district level, especially at the school level, related to SIT planning, were so that at this stage we could even further empower schools, right, to make their own decisions. Because
what's SIT planning? I don't want to interrupt.
I'm so
you, but
sorry.
You said something, and I'm
school
like,
improvement planning,
okay,
which is the you. Kind of disciplined way of working we've adopted at the school level for decision making.
Okay.
And school level focus areas. We want, now that those disciplined ways of working are pretty embedded, like they're part of our culture and our way of working. We can actually further empower schools to do what they think is right for their school community, right? And in collaboration with their students, their mm-hmm, staff, mm-hmm. their families. We the new strategic framework kind of lays out a strategy for further empowerment of schools. Same thing for the classroom experience. Now that we have more coherence, right, instructionally as a system, I do think that now we're at the stage where what we can and should be thinking about is how to ensure that the teachers have the freedom they need to ensure that those are not just nurturing environments that build community, which is essential, but that there's deep and rich learning happening in the classroom. Right, it's not standards alignment isn't enough. It's got to be instruction that's meaningful to the children who are in the classroom. Right, it's got to be content where students can see themselves represented mm-hmm. in the curriculum. Right, so that they can understand the world around them and interrogate it. Like, I just think that we're poised to bring instruction to another level in Madison without losing the coherence that we've created, right? We can empower schools to make decisions for their communities without losing those disciplined ways of working that we think are essential
to
success.
What does that say about Madison when you inherited it, that it really didn't have this structure? It really was a city that, you know, again, I've been here for... How long have I been here?
Yeah,
I don't know, 20 years now? I don't know, something. So I certainly don't know the history of this city, but I know the gentlemen before you were white men that perhaps didn't mind that school A was completely different than school B. They didn't think about the academics because that wasn't, they weren't, I don't want to slam these gentlemen at all, but mm-hmm. but for some reason, that wasn't Madison's priority. How sort of surprising.
There's a whole lot to unpack there, isn't there, Carousel? But I don't know. All I know is what I've experienced. And not just me, but the people who have led in Madison, the teacher leaders who are on their school-based leadership teams, the principals, the senior team of Madison, we are hardcore educators, right, who have put the educational experience at the center, right? The theory that we have Adapted for Change has been focused on improving the experience that students have with their teachers around content that's worth learning, right? That is the hard slog of school improvement, right? Yeah.
We're talking with Dr. Jennifer Cheatham, superintendent of Madison Public Schools. We'd love your questions or comments. Please join the conversation. The phone call, the phone number is area code 608-256-2001. You can also send us a tweet at WORT Talk or a message on our Facebook page. Our page is A Public Affair, 89.9 FM, Madison. So, Jen, let's talk about race.
Okay.
And it seems to intersect with everything that we do. Mm-hmm. Big picture is, our president is racist. I think our country is racist. Is Madison racist?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I
think every individual. I think I'm racist. I live in Wisconsin. I live in the United States. I'm racist.
I am too. I'm married to a black man, and I have a biracial son, and I'm racist. Mm-hmm. It is. I've gotten myself into so much trouble for saying those words, Carousel.
Really?
Yeah. I think, you know, it's funny. I
love saying those words.
Oh, man.
That's the conversation we were talking about at the beginning. Can we at least start there? Let's admit it.
Right. I think out of all of the challenges that I've experienced in Madison, being able to lead for racial equity, to try to be an increasingly anti-racist leader, which means doing my own work, right? Mm-hmm. It means doing my own inside-out work simultaneously alongside everyone else who's an educator in Madison. That has been the most challenging aspect of this work and the most fulfilling in some ways, right? The most important, the most powerful, and the most challenging.
Let's sort of break it down in so many pieces. Does this fit in with the conversation about the behavioral education plan?
I think it does.
We used to suspend and expel students of color at a tremendously high rate. I didn't pull up the numbers from 6 years ago. I'm happy I didn't, because we don't need the numbers in front of us for you and I to admit the things that we've already admitted.
Mm-hmm.
And then along came the behavioral education plan that was really a challenging new way to look at things.
Yeah. I want to zoom out before we zoom back into this, because I do think it's a great example of this work in action. I think in my first 5 years, we certainly were leading for racial equity. And the main approach we were taking was to let me think. A couple of things. We were certainly talking a lot about what it means for all of us to be culturally responsive educators, right? How do we build relationships with students of color, especially in a district where most of us, most educators, are white and white females like me? And at the central office level, at the district level, we were very interested in both investing resources and tackling the institutional barriers that stood in the way of success for students of color and their families, right? So we've been all along, you know, working on addressing those systems and structures. You know, we rewrote our strategic framework a couple years ago now, launched it a year ago in the fall, and tried, we thought we were ready, and I think we were, to take it to a whole nother level and be even more explicit in that commitment, right? We use the word anti-racism, right? That we are, as educators, obligated to be actively anti-racist.
You intentionally had a piece that talked about black excellence.
Yeah.
We are focusing on our black students to rise them up. And even though I think there has been criticism from the community of, oh, black excellence, let's see it. But that's the whole point. You're, at least you're putting it out there. If you never put it out there,
you can't hold yourself accountable.
That's
right.
And you can't measure your failures. So the community that wants to tell us we're failing, at least we're saying, you're right, we said black excellence and we're not meeting it at all.
No doubt. And both of these those things are different, but have to happen simultaneously, right? You have to lead for black excellence, which is, I mean, what is implied, I hope, in those words is that black students are already excellent. Right. And that it is our job to cultivate that excellence, and that we have an obligation simultaneously while we're cultivating black excellence to recognize and dismantle racism in all of its forms. I mean, we're educators, so we're held to a higher standard. This is a really big deal. I think for me, that work that we launched last year, what I wish I would have done better was to kind of preview for everybody what it might feel like, right? That we would feel excited and motivated by the commitment. And then when we started actually doing more of the work and holding ourselves accountable for it every time, not just sometimes, that it would create a feeling of like not knowing, of disequilibrium, of not sure, being sure about your next step. What I think it's produced a lot in Madison right now is this feeling of who's on the good side and who's on the bad side,
yep.
Right? Like,
yep.
Which is really...
Lines are very drawn.
They're very drawn. It's fine because it is a step in the process. We just can't stay there. Right. Like what we need to do as a community is say, OK, right. This is a natural feeling. Right. When you're faced with our own right racism, the racism of the institution that we work for. Right. Mm-hmm. Like I have this ambivalent relationship with any school district. I love it because I'm rooting for it. And I hate it because it was kind of born out of racist ideals mm-hmm. in many, right? I mean, that's the reality.
That's the whole concept of institutional racism.
Right, that's what it is.
This is, you're fulfilling your actual intentional institutional design,
right.
Which leads to racism.
So it is natural to go through this feeling of disequilibrium, to worry that you're not on the good side, right? And if we stay there, things, we may actually... we will suffer as a result. We have to pull together and have that dialogue that we were talking about earlier in the show. Like we have to not let people leave the table, but bring them back in loving and compassionate ways. I actually think that Madison and the school district, which is kind of at the center of Madison, will be stronger as a result of this dialogue, right? We're going to get through it and we are going to be better.
The hope of the future.
Yeah, I have no question about it because there is a movement underway in Madison, not just in the school district. I mean, our educators are phenomenal people who get it and are working hard to do this inside out work and make our institution a better institution for every child. I have no doubt. But we have to stop pitting ourselves against one another, right? We have to stop looking for someone to blame and just accept that this is our reality, right? It's not just ours.
We've got to fix it.
Yeah. And we're the people who are in these seats now, right? We're the people doing the work.
We're the leaders. Let's do it.
Yeah.
We have a question that came in. Jen had a question on Facebook. Thank you, Jen, for contributing to the conversation and using Facebook. Excellent. It does get relayed over to me. Yay, success, technology. She wanted to ask you, Dr. Cheatham, to talk about what parents can do. I almost said carrots. I don't know why. Maybe I'm hungry. Okay, start over. Jen wants to know what parents can do to push the schools forward and to work on race and equity issues.
Oh, excellent.
And I'm going to put my own little spin on
yeah,
that.
Yeah, go for it.
I think there are different conversations versus white parents of color, I know that there's so much intentional effort, and we can talk about the successes there, of getting families and communities involved. But we also live in a time where when people say, where are the parents, which I hear all the time, my answer is, I don't know, working three jobs, trying to not get evicted, taking the bus that doesn't actually get them to where they're going. They are just hoping that their kid is safe at school. They don't have time to meet with the teacher because they don't have enough time and money to fight being evicted, which is what they're working on. And those are not, I don't think that's anecdotal. As a tenant rights attorney, I think those are the very real lives of many, many people.
Absolutely.
But sorry, Jen, I co-opted your question there. But can you help us understand the complexity of wanting parents involved, needing parents involved, and also acknowledging that parents have overwhelming things of basic needs on their plate?
Parent partnership has been a steady focus for us as well. I mean, it was one of the major priorities in our initial strategic framework. Shout out to Nichelle Nichols, who's been rocking it in that role.
She's sort of one of the greatest of Madison.
She is amazing. And our whole focus there has been on parents as partners, right? As full partners in the educational process. We have always felt that parents don't need to be present in the traditional ways, which is what you were kind of getting at a minute ago, Carousel, to be our partners. But they need great communication. They need to know what's happening with their child at school so that they can play a part in the ways that are possible for them. Meaning, sometimes the most important thing a parent can do is just to check in with their kid, right? Mm-hmm. To talk about it, to encourage them, right? You don't have to come to the PTO or PTA meeting.
You don't have to know
meeting.
How they did on their math test to say, hey, how's school going? Do you feel safe and happy there? Are you challenged? I love you. I know you're smart.
Right. Yeah, no question.
Which every parent, of course, does. That's what every loving parent does.
Absolutely.
When they have a free 5 minutes at the end of the day, sometimes they
don't.
There
are all kinds of ways to be partners with teachers. I've talked to a lot of parents over the years, and I'll tell you that relationship between the parent and the teacher is the one that's most important to most parents, right? That's a relationship they want to have be really strong. Mm-hmm. I think to the Facebook question.
Yes.
What I'm reading into that is how beyond the typical parent partnership can parents be involved, especially around this work on race and equity. Mm-hmm. And I would encourage especially the white parents in Madison to think very carefully about and deeply about this question. White parents, especially parents of privilege, unintentionally kind of hold up the systems and structures that need to be dissembled if every child is going to be successful.
The wrong idea as a white parent, and I'm a white parent in a predominantly white neighborhood in a predominantly white school, that we don't have to talk about racism.
Right.
Don't talk about it. We're not racist, so we don't talk about race, which is actually the wrong response when we live in a racist world.
Right. Yeah. I mean, students need to talk about it, right? They need to make sense out of this world around them, especially if they're going to make it a better place. I think that's essential. I think I've seen some leaders, especially PTO and PTA leaders, really lead this conversation well over the last couple of years. Mm. I've seen PTO and PTA leaders introducing book clubs to read books like Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility, right, among parents to better understand why they're having some of the responses that they're having to our efforts to address racial equity head on. I mean, I would encourage parents to be thinking about that. What inside out work do they need to do, right? It's not about what we do in the big ways necessarily, the big initiatives. It's what we do in the small ways, our one-on-one conversations with our fellow parents, right? How we challenge one another. I think that's really important.
And do you see those changes? There's so much to talk about, and we only have 20 more minutes, which is crazy. But do you see these changes happening in Madison? These conversations of and I think that's the natural progressive, is to start with anger. What? We're not racist. What are you talking about? My kid got a great education. I love Madison schools. Are you attacking Madison schools?
Yeah.
We need to protect our schools.
Yeah.
To sort of, okay, well, actually, here's a conversation. I just gave a, here's my tangent on this. I just gave a presentation on criminal justice reform to Jewish social services. And part of a tiny piece of my talk was about police in schools.
Mm-hmm.
A tiny piece. And it was just acknowledging the school to prison pipeline. And hey, here's the percentage of African American students that get tickets when our police are in our schools. And all of a sudden people go, oh, that's why you're mad about police in schools.
Mm.
And that people in that room actually said that to me. They weren't ready to say we don't need police in schools.
Nope.
But at least there was a moment of understanding that hadn't trickled down to them of why would people, only criminals are afraid of the police kind of thing. And I think that's what you're getting at, is that do you see those conversations happening?
I do. I mean, I think there is a powerful an exciting movement underway in Madison, that more and more people, not just our educators, but Madisonians are getting into this dialogue with one another, right? In the small moments and in the big ones. And I think that bodes well for the future of Madison. We can't step out of it. We can't pit people against one another. Even the police and schools issue, I mean, it's such a good example, Carousel. I think that by criticizing and raising serious questions about the issue, shouldn't be misread as being anti-police,
right.
But it always ends up sounding that way,
right? And there might be people on that position that are anti-police, but that's not the core of what they're saying. And you use the excuse of anti-police to stop listening
to
what they're saying.
You got it. It's a really easy way to shut down the conversation. And what I want us all is to stay in it together. Right? Let's not shut down the conversation. Let's figure out what is the real problem that we are trying to solve. And if we can do that, we're going to be okay.
And you feel like we're moving. So back to Madison schools. Talk to us about some of the programs and the initiatives that you feel are moving us, especially there was a caller and he got disconnected. Sorry about that, Dan. He had a question about the achievement gap. And I don't know the details of what his question was, but moving forward with how do we address the racial equity that exists?
Yeah. Well, I think that's what this new strategic framework is all about. I'm very hopeful. The board, I think, is very supportive of continuing to move in this direction. And I would hope would find a future leader who's capable of leading this work. But yeah, I think we're poised for really, really powerful things.
What needs to happen to end racial disparities in Madison schools?
Oh, gosh. I mean, there's not any one thing, right? I mean, I think at the center of it, if I had to pick one thing, Carousel, it would be to, for everything that we do to be ultimately aimed at seeing each other's humanity. Does that sound too fluffy? That's what we need to do, right? Everything we do, the way we organize schools, right, through the school improvement planning process and our decisions about instructional design, if we made all those decisions to make sure that you experience a school day in a deeply humane way, right, where you're seen as a human being, that's seeing the teacher as a full, human being, seeing every student in their full humanity, every parent. I mean, it's interesting, right? Like, what if that were the design principle for every decision we made and moving forward?
What does that look like? I mean, I know that there's conversations about schools have become too academic focused sometimes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't know how you deal with this. You get it from both directions. We're not meeting our academic right. needs. We're not academic focused at all. And we're too academic focused. Can my kid please take a dance class and a ceramics class and something that makes them feel like a beautiful person?
I think that the strategies, I'm going to make some assumptions about what the caller called about. Mm-hmm. The strategies that have been put into play over the last 20 years to quote unquote close the achievement gap, that term drives me absolutely crazy, by the way.
Why? Because what we're talking about is racism. We're not talking about achievement gap.
Yeah, I don't think it's actually describing the actual problem that we're trying to solve. Mm-hmm. But I think that the strategies that have been put into play, which have been largely about being more prescriptive on academics, how we teach literacy, how do we teach math, about intervention, so giving double and triple doses of literacy and math if a student is struggling. I think that those strategies, I mean, we need to teach literacy and math well. Mm-hmm. I mean, don't get me wrong.
That's
I don't
what
want
an
anyone
education
to,
system
yeah,
is.
I don't want anyone to misinterpret me here. But the intense focus on only that has actually, I think, set us backwards and not pushed us forward. I think that if we had, and this is where the district is going now, building on the coherence that we've created, if districts were more focused on deep and rich learning experiences for students, if imagine young Black students saw themselves in their curriculum, right, from day one, if they were getting access to a historically accurate depiction, right, of mm-hmm. the world in which they live, if they were... how do I say this? If they were consistently seen as fully human, right? Too many Black students in this country are dehumanized on a regular basis. I think we would see those results change much, much faster. So the next level of work in Madison is all about that, empowering everyone in a school community to create a holistic instructional experience, investing in teachers as culturally responsive teachers who are actively anti-racist, ensuring that the learning experience offers one that is deep and rich, right, and relevant to the students who attend our schools. I mean, that work is already underway in Madison, and I feel like that is the key to transformation.
So all of these things
mm-hmm.
sound wonderful.
I know.
They cost money.
Yeah, let's talk about money.
Let's talk about that. Wisconsin, the United States, but Wisconsin, award-winning Wisconsin, we do not fund our public schools.
No.
And one of the, from my perspective, from what I've seen, as a parent and someone that cares about these issues, from the behavioral education plan, for example, mm-hmm. was that there weren't enough support for teachers and in our schools because we don't have enough money to hire a dozen social workers in every school. I mean, people always talk about, let's get at our knees. I want to have social workers sitting around doing nothing because we've hired so many of them. I mean, I dream of that, of a school just overflowing with abundance of people ready at any moment. But that is a complete fantasy that is not based in any reality of how we fund schools in Wisconsin.
Yeah. I agree entirely. I mean, the scarcity model. I mean, I don't know. I've been an educator for over 20 years. And sometimes you've been living in scarcity, and for me, working in scarcity for so long, you forget what's possible, right? Like you
accept it as the norm.
You accept it as the norm. I know. It's terrible. And we shouldn't accept it as the norm. I was thrilled when Tony Evers got elected. I'm not shy about saying that. Mm-hmm. And
he cares about public education.
He sure does. He gets it. I think the proposal that he put forward was really inspired and inspiring, and not fantasy land. I mean, he was trying to lay out for all of us a picture of what it actually looks like to fund education, public education, appropriately. I was happy to see that we got a little bit of bump in per pupil aid for next year, which is great. But
it's still not enough.
No.
And the problem is that, right, if my daughters don't get things in their school, my daughters have piano lessons. My daughter has, you know, dance classes. Our neighbor's daughter has a math tutor. All of these things that if you can't get it at school, people with money can help supplement our excellent schools that are starved to death. I can supplement it, but that costs thousands of dollars a year.
Yeah, which makes
what I do.
So ultimately, the disparities get bigger.
They get
worse. I think that's exactly right, Carousel. I'm not giving up on Governor Evers is trying to accomplish, and I don't think anyone should. We should be funding full day 4K in the state of Wisconsin. I mean, that is an absolute must.
Mm-hmm.
We should be funding reimbursement for special ed services. That is an absolute must. I mean, we should be fully funding services for English language learners, which is not happening now. I mean, the list goes on mm-hmm. and on and on. I'll tell you, we make we do a lot with very little. Our kids and our teachers and our parents deserve much more. But there's no doubt about that.
What do you hope to see in the next superintendent? What is your, you know, the team comes together. You don't really get a say in it.
I don't.
The team you were part of gets a say in it.
Yeah.
You know, what do you think are the school board should be looking at when they choose? Hopefully they have many qualified applicants to choose from, but everyone brings their own unique strengths and weaknesses to the table.
Yeah.
What are the strengths you think they should be looking for?
Well, I mean, this superintendent will be starting from a fairly strong foundation, right? I mean, they're not going to have
to. Don't say so yourself.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, they're not going to have to redo their HR systems. The budget, despite the challenges we just described, is solid. We have, there's a lot to work from there. So, I mean, part of what I hope is that they're looking for someone who can lead this kind of next level of work, right? And that's got to be someone who has a fairly robust vision and deep understanding of the kind of transformational change that we're trying to make now. And we're trying to make changes in instructional design that are truly transformative. The community schools model, right? That is a different mm-hmm. way of doing school. Pathways at the high school level, that's a different way of doing school.
There's pushback on all of them.
Yeah.
I'm scared of pathways.
And it's going to be amazing.
Good. I'm scared of what West High School looks like when my kids get there.
Well, because it is a different instructional design, right? I mean, this is a longer conversation,
we
are trying to change the way schooling looks and feels for students so that they're actually thriving in school and truly prepared for post-secondary. And I would hope that we would get a leader who can lead that transformational effort. I do think the district and the school board should be looking for someone who can continue to keep racial equity at the center. I don't think there are many enough education leaders and superintendents who cannot just talk that talk but walk it. So I'm hopeful that they'll look for somebody who can continue that work as well. I think the last thing I would say is there are a lot of leaders out there who don't understand teaching. This is maybe what you were getting to when you talked about my predecessors a little bit, but I would hope that they're looking for someone who has really strong instructional leadership skills, right? Who really has
a vision.
They
know what it feels like to be in the classroom.
Yes, I think it's really important. I had always wished that I could have taken a week every year and gotten back into a classroom and co-taught with a teacher. I was never able to quite pull it off. I hope that for the next superintendent, right, to stay really grounded
in
the work
that
teachers do.
What is happening in
our
schools.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And do you think, I know the school board has talked about referendums. Do you think those are things that we should be moving forward? Both, I know there's conversation about building referendums and operational referendums. They've been supported in Madison. I'm hopeful. I would hope that our school district, if they think that's the right thing to do, would go for it.
I would hope so. I mean, we've been working on that long-range facilities plan for years. I mean, we didn't even talk about some of the other things that we've done, right? We've made some facilities improvements already. But the plan that is shaping up on facilities, which would lead with the four comprehensive high schools, the alternative high school, Capital High, and address South Madison, some major gaps in learning at the elementary level. I think the package that will shape up is going to be powerful. Both the school board and the new superintendent, I think, needs to lead that work forward. The buildings that we have are old, 50 years on average. We need to take good care of them, and our students deserve to learn in spaces that reflect our value of them.
That are inspiring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's about deep learning, too.
Well, it's been wonderful to have you. I want to wish you great success as you move on to your next adventures. But you're still here for a couple more weeks.
Oh, yeah.
Deep in it.
Yeah, I'm thrilled. I'm transitioning to Jane Belmore as the interim, as you know.
That's the new interim. And will she serve the goal, the setup is she'll serve for the duration of the next school year?
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh, that's right. And she starts August 1st. She was the interim when I started. So I transitioned with her in those first months.
She's an old pro at this job.
She sure is. And it's been a pleasure to transition with her. I think the district will be in very good hands with Jane next year. Thanks, Carousel.
Well, that's good. Maybe I'll put a bug in Jane's ear and get her
on the show
to talk about the challenges of being a leader that isn't a permanent leader. That's a whole new world of it. But when do you head off to Boston? You still have a couple more weeks. Are there anything left that you're really focusing on that you hope to work on in the next few weeks?
Well, the next couple of weeks, I'm getting the senior team with Jane set for next year. Mm-hmm. We want to make sure that the group is ready to rock and roll. The big kickoff of the year happens in the second week of August, meaning our big leadership institute, which is really the signal that the school year is starting.
Welcoming back teachers and
starting
all
with
that.
The administrators and the leadership teams, which includes teachers, and then a couple weeks later, all the teachers. So we're working on making sure that welcome back plan is strong, that the team is ready to rock and roll, and they will be. There's a strong team here in Madison. I'm leaving, but the team that is here, both the principals, the leadership teams at the school level and at the district level, is a very, they're an impressive group, to say the least. So Madison's in good hands.
Wonderful. Well, again, thank you so much, Dr. Jen Cheatham, Madison superintendent for 6+ years. Thank you for your leadership. Thank you for facing the challenges and the criticism and the successes and all of that. And we wish you great success in Boston.
Thanks, Carousel.
And thanks, everyone, for listening today. Exciting news. I'm actually filling in for Ali's show tomorrow, so you're going to hear me again.
Well.
Get used to my fabulous voice. It's coming back tomorrow. But thank you to Tim for engineering, Rochelle for producing. I think Anita and Joe have been working on the phones. Thanks, everyone, for your great work. Have a great day. Bye.
This is WORT 89.9 FM, Madison. It's 1 o'clock. This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics. On today's show,
the Defender is reporting largely on lifestyle events for African Americans. That was always something that they were very determined to do, is to record the births and deaths and weddings and prosperous moments and less so graduations. Everything that the white press ignored African Americans doing, the Defender was going to do that. But it was also a very strong advocate against lynching and Jim Crow and segregation.
After 114 years of publishing, Chicago's historic black newspaper, The Defender, has published its last print edition last week, though it does continue online. Today we'll be in conversation about the history of this iconic newspaper with former Defender reporter Ethan Macaeli. Ethan Macaeli is the author of the book The Defender, How the Legendary Black Newspaper Changed America. That's next on Letters in Politics. But first, the news.
Hello, I'm Marion Marshall with the BBC News. In the past half hour, the outgoing German Defence Minister, Ursula von der Leyen, has been elected President of the European Commission, the EU's top job, despite stiff opposition. From Strasbourg, Damien Grammaticus has just sent this report.
In Ursula von der Leyen, the EU will now have its first woman as President of the European Commission. European leaders will be breathing a sigh of relief. It took days of fraught negotiations and a difficult compromise among EU countries to nominate Ms. von der Leyen, a German conservative and close ally of Angela Merkel. She needed